Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. My name is Alex Linder and I'm with VNNforum.com, where you can find everything that we discuss and record as part of our Learning College and Vanguard Audiobooks. Now, what we're going to do today is the third of four sections from Francis Parker Yaki's The Enemy of Europe, which he wrote after his masterwork, Imperium, which we have already recorded. So, let's go with section three of The Enemy of Europe, which I believe was written in about 1952. I'm looking at a reprint from, coupled with Oliver's book from 1981. Section 3 is called The Morphology of the Third World War. Contains four chapters: the American occupation of Europe, the demise of the Western nations, the inner enemy of Europe, and the outer enemies of Europe. It goes from page 36 to 61. First chapter, The American Occupation of Europe. After the Second World War, the opponents of the hero of that war were still dominated by his compelling personality. Either they took up his ideas and declared them their own, or they continued to fight against him. Of a new idea, independent of that hero, there was not a trace. This can be explained by the issues in world politics being the same as those of the Second World War, for the war solved no power problems, having neither followed nor changed an organic power current. During the war, some Europeans entertained the comfortable illusion that the Washington regime was hostile only to certain states in Europe, certain culture peoples in Europe, certain ideas in Europe. Nevertheless, the Washington regime's real enemy was Europe, which means, above all, the culture-bearing stratum of Europe. That invisible stratum of the population that, by virtue of its sensitivity to cultural imperatives, is the custodian of the destiny of the Western civilization, and will remain so, too, until the end of Western history. This stratum of approximately 250,000 souls is distributed throughout Europe, but naturally it is concentrated primarily in Germany, which can be attributed to the organic fact that the Prussian-German nation is destined to actualize the European Imperium. Since this stratum is invisible, who could have looked at Rembrandt, Goethe, Napoleon, Bismarck in the cradle and seen what they were to become? The Washington regime began its post-war task of liquidating this stratum by attempting to kill all of those who had already proved themselves an elite. Herod sought to kill the Christ child by slaughtering all male infants in Bethlehem of 2 years and under. To the invaders, it did not seem feasible to take over this technique in its entirety. Yet they believed that if they extinguished the elite of the past, they would ipso facto prevent the formation of a new elite, that of the future. Hence they proceeded with a monstrous black mass of scaffold trials, unique in history, that were intended to kill off everybody whose war service in a particular field had been of outstanding merit. These black masses, variously called Entnazifierung, the denazification, epuration, and the like in various countries, were performed in all parts of Europe at the behest of the Washington regime. Even in such countries as Sweden and Switzerland, which had not participated in the war, the Washington regime had certain people hunted down, tried, and killed. By these methods, thousands of the best minds were liquidated, but that was still not enough. Huge masses of human beings had to be butchered in a certain way, at least. Herod's method had to be applied. Accordingly, laws, quote-unquote, and whenever he talks about Nuremberg and related happenings, he puts legal law trial are always in quotes. I'm not going to say it every time, but every time they're in quotes to show you that it's not a serious trial, and he's even going to explain why that is, but just know that. Accordingly, laws, whacka-whacka, were devised for ex post facto application. Everyone who in the past believed in the establishment of European Imperium, who worked for it, was a criminal. Notice how he's using his own vocabulary for where we would see Nazi in Jewish publications. And he uses culture distorter for Jews, most commonly. The penalty, wacka wacka, for this crime, wacka wacka, of obeying the historical imperative of our age could not be a single simple imprisonment for a definite term. That would be impossible. Murder millions and by steel and cord? No, millions of individuals had to be ruined for the rest of their lives. Hundreds of thousands of French, Walloon, Flemish, Dutch, Danish, and Norwegian soldiers returned home after years of battle against Asiatic Russia and found themselves accused of treason, wacka wacka, and condemned to death or sentenced to years of imprisonment in concentration camps. In Belgium alone, the Americans incarcerated 400,000 from a population of 8 million. For under the Neue Ordnung of the Washington regime, the struggle of Europeans for the survival and power of Europe was designated treason. Thus, an American colonel acting as a judge, again quotes, in a, quote, war crimes trial, told a European soldier who had carried out the orders of his superior officers, "You could have deserted." After being released from the overflowing concentration camps, the criminals, quote-unquote, were robbed of every possession, sentenced to heavy fines, deprived of all civil rights, which made it nearly impossible for them to earn their livelihood, and forbidden to perform any but the meanest sorts of labor. The American High Command fiercely pursued a policy that brought about a uniform impoverishment of the Europeans to whom it contemptuously referred as the indigenous population. Years after the war, the High Command deliberately blew up European factories or dismantled and shipped them to Asiatic Russia, chopped down giant forests in Germany that had provided timber years before Columbus discovered America, confiscated large sections of European cities and forbade Europeans to enter them, drove from their homes, cruelly and unexpectedly, hundreds of thousands of European families so as to make room for those of the occupation soldiers of America and her satellite regimes, set a daily ration of 1,000 calories for adults, which corresponds to only one-third of the amount needed to sustain human life, forbade its occupation soldiers to give or sell Europeans food and clothing, even to speak to them. And finally, it proclaimed to Europe that the Americans had come as a heron folk, a master folk, possessed of great understanding for political realities and morality, to liberate Europeans and educate them, quote-unquote, up to true democracy, capital TD. Although the American occupation used the slogan democracy, it did not make even a pretense of introducing 19th century democratic forms. The press, political parties, every kind of gathering, every move, everything required a license. This was the substitution of a negative, mechanical Führerprinzip for the natural, organic, authoritarian state founded upon the inwardly imperative principle of ethical socialism, which is the destined state form of Europe in this age of absolute politics. Ethical socialism is the destined state form of Europe in the age of absolute politics. This was the tyranny of capitalist liberalism, using the mere methods of the European state form without understanding their spiritual content. The freedom of speech America brought to Europe by conquest is best shown through the example of Bevin, the English Foreign Secretary. In 1948, he spoke publicly of financial servitude to Wall Street, and within one day was forced to beg its pardon in public. Doesn't that remind you of modern day where people are quicker? They say something honest, it just more or less escapes them, like an uncontrolled idea fart, and then the next day they quickly are brought to heel and forced to apologize, or feel they have to apologize. The American occupation brought into the open a whole stratum of the European population that had hitherto never been recognized as a unit. In Germany, the expression Der Deutsche Michael has long been current. It pertains to the type with anti-national instincts and enthusiast for talk instead of action. Likewise for anti-social individualism, laissez-faire, and parliamentarism. A person who cringes to aliens. A natural, instinctive, organic traitor. This stratum of the German population worked systematically but quite instinctively in two world wars for a victory of the enemy. Like the culture-bearing stratum, the Michel type is distributed Europe-wide. In every European country, America has an inner America, the Michel stratum, as an advertisement for its political success, and pseudo-Europeans it uses to implement its policies locally. Such Europeans are called Churchills. after the best-known member of their species. Finally, the American occupation of Europe demonstrated irrefutably that England's policy of isolation from the rest of Europe, from the European family of nations to which it belongs, was a grotesque anachronism in the 20th century, the age of absolute politics, of the struggle for control of the planet, wherein only great powers with a large geographic basis can take part, not tiny islands situated close to the continent. In the age of economics and nationalism, the policy of isolation, like the balance of power idea, was justified. Much that was right, correct, natural, and justified in the 19th century is in the 20th century merely past history. In that century, it was possible for England alone to conquer and hold in check India. In this century, that no longer lies within the realm of possibility. In that century, sea power could be employed decisively. In this century, sea power is no longer decisive, since the entire hinterland is politically active. Remember, he said that's the result of World War I, is that the outer forces saw Europe destroying itself, and that empowered them to become more active politically and saying, well, geez, we can break free of them. They're weak now. It was tragic that England held so long to the isolation doctrine, for that made possible Washington's policy of a second fratricidal war. The isolation idea thus contributed its part to the loss of Europe's world hegemony. However, this idea survives today only in the sclerotic brains of culturally backward old men. What is decisive is the fact of Europe's passing, together with all the other European countries and peoples, into the common status of subjection to America, not the feigning of unimpaired English sovereignty by a certain stratum left over from the past. England's community of destiny with the rest of Europe is now patent to everybody in the world, is everywhere binding, and can be denied neither in the individual nor for one moment. End of that first chapter of Section 3. Second chapter, The Demise of the Western Nations. In one of its results, the Second World War showed the entire world that the age of nationalism is forever past. Precisely those nations whose enmities had reached such fantastic proportions in that age ceased to exist as political units. There is no relation of cause and effect here, for the nation ideas have a certain lifespan, just as every aspect of a culture's existence, and every Western nation died when it was organically its turn. The last phase of a nation idea is its political one. The oldest of the Western nations, the first to have attained the political phase of its development, was Spain. Its great period began with the unification of Aragon and Castile and reached its summit with the world ascendancy of Charles V. The last act of Spanish history was the revolt against Napoleon, and even then the resistance was more primitive and racial than national. After that period, Spain no longer played an independent role in Western history, though, of course, it retained a common destiny with the Western culture and was conscious of it. France entered its political phase in the time of Richelieu and appeared in Western history as a spiritually independent people until the turn of the century. The last affirmative act of this nation manifested itself in 1914 at the Marne. Austria was a great power from the time of Charles V until 1900, although in the course of the 19th century it became less and less sure of itself. The linguistic form of the nation idea in the Western culture, which dominated that century, weakened the Austrian idea to the point where Austria's last independent political act, the ultimatum to Serbia in June 1914, was dictated more by pride than politics. England's political history as a nation extends from Cromwell to Joseph Chamberlain. Before Cromwell, there was no world idea in England, and after Chamberlain, an idea no longer existed, could no longer exist, for national extinction, like every other organic phenomenon, is irreversible. Between 1600 and 1900, England's power increased to the extent that, in 1900, it controlled by its fleets and armies 17/20 of the surface of the earth. Spiritually, the entire Western civilization, particularly from 1750 onwards, was anglicized. The thought and action systems of the 19th century were English. Marxism arose on the basis of English capitalist economics. Darwinism reflects the English individualistic competitive world outlook. Materialism, legalism, capitalism, social ethics, All are of English provenance, and they were the foundations of the 19th century. The Boer War occurred at the turning point. At that time, wrote the Englishman Christopher Sykes, England suddenly became the most hated country in Europe. All at once, the spiritual center of gravity shifted. Darwinism succumbed to the mutation theory of De Vries, the class warfare of Marx to the organic state socialism of Bismarck, social ethics to political ethics, centralist philosophy to the idealist laissez-faire, laissez-faire to state intervention in the economy. Well, that was driven as much from England as anywhere else with the Fabian Society, where they do it degree by degree, non-violently instead of violently, as Marx called for, / predicted. And he's still continuing his list of these changes. Liberalism to the precursors of the reawakening of authority, pacifism to the reassertion of martial values, and daydreams of an eternal peace were shattered in the global arena of the absolute age of politics. This was the end of the intellectual, spiritual Anglicization of Europe, but not of America, for colonies have their own organic rhythm, as the history of high culture shows, and all colonies are, perforce, culturally retarded. And it was the beginning of the new nation idea of the West, the entire culture itself constituted as a nation, i.e. as an imperium. The culture is a nation, the imperium. So he's got plant, animal, man, higher culture is his idea or creation. And the entire culture constitutes a nation, i.e. an imperium. As nations, Germany and Italy were destined by the advent of the new age, that namely that of absolute politics, to be stifled before they had yet lived through the mature political phase of their existence. Unlike France, Spain, Austria, and England, however, these two nations are inwardly alive, i.e. their nation idea, their national mission, is not fulfilled. Spain fulfilled itself before the age of nationalism, France and Austria during that age, England and the age of nationalism unfolded concurrently, and Germany and Italy must fulfill themselves after the age of nationalism. Thus, these two nations will not fulfill themselves in a nationalistic form in the old sense of the word. They will fulfill themselves as the custodians of the destiny of all of Europe. And the new nation idea of culture and nation, or culture as nation, will be the instrument of their fulfillment. As political units, of course, Germany and Italy are dead. It lies beyond all possibility that one or the other could ever regain its sovereignty except as part of a sovereign Europe. Both stand in the shadow of American Russia, which falls over all Europe. However, the German and Italian peoples possess the instincts that alone guarantee a role in history. The three great instincts upon which all power is based are the absolute will to self-preservation, to procreation, and to increasing power. The first and last instincts directly describe superpersonal organisms, the second only indirectly through the human beings that compose the body of the higher organism. A nation that welcomes foreign troops in is no longer fit to live. Such a thing is rendered impossible by the absolute instinct for self-preservation, which excludes submission to any other organism, whether friend or foe. A nation in numerical decline is moribund. The size of the population is the result of the national mission. A nation that no longer strives for power and possessions is dying. And the actual renunciation of power, even by traitorous Churchills, means the nation is dead, for a living nation simply does not surrender its power. Again, that's tautological. He's defining the thing by the thing he's measuring. The great nation-forming ethic in this stage of European history is the Prussian-German idea of ethical socialism. Only this living, wordless idea can banish the overshadowing extra-European powers, form the European Imperium, and lead the West to the fulfillment of its world mission. Imbued with the new ethic of free of petty statist 19th-century nationalism, the European nations will climb out of the abyss as a unity, or they will never climb out at all. Germany is the only surviving nation of Europe that contains formative possibilities, and so it has become identical with the West. Since the destiny of Europe is at once that of the Imperium, which can take only an authoritarian socialist form, Prussian Germany is the custodian of the destiny of all of Europe. This is an organic fact, and it is wholly independent of human logic or wishes. Destiny is at work in what exists, not what disgruntled old men wish existed. This relationship of Germany to Europe was confirmed by the Second World War. While the war continued, there was power based in Europe. The very moment the European phase of the war ceased, there was no longer any power in Europe, all power decisions being made in Washington and Moscow, or with their permission. The German resistance to the American-Russian invasion was no 19th century nationalism, since the whole culture-bearing stratum in Europe took part in the struggle, and troops for battles came not only from the German-speaking territories, but voluntarily from every other part of Europe as well. Words that in the 19th century described nation ideas describe in the 20th century only geographic ideas. Today the words German, Spanish, English, Italian, French describe only languages and territories, but no longer peoples, nations, political units, or superpersonal ideas. Since a mysterious force inheres in the words when they are used polemically, a policy for European liberation that would attain success will not use the geographic and linguistic words England, France, Italy, Spain, Germany in a political sense, but will use the word Europe alone. The advance of history has destroyed the old significance of these words, and a dynamic policy needs its own terminology. Today, 19th century nationalists are the instruments of the occupying forces, which follow the old maxim, divide et impera, divide and conquer. What European would dare speak openly in favor of the American occupation of Europe? What European would declare himself against Europe's organic unification, against its resurrection as a sovereign unit of culture, state, nation, people, race, all hyphenated, as is his way? Using the old appellations of nationality, one can say without paradoxical intent that in the 20th century, an Englishman, an Italian, a Spaniard, is a German. In this century, it is of scant importance what language a European speaks and in what geographic area he was brought up. Of importance only is the spirituality that permeates his inner life. Europe's Churchills and Toynbees prove that it is possible for Americans to be born and raised in Europe. The example of Mussolini shows that an ethical Prussian can be born and raised in the Romagna, and the examples of Ezra Pound, William Joyce, Robert Best, Douglas Chandler, and others show that Europeans can be born or raised in America. So he's saying, again, race is a spiritual matter, not a matter of geography or language. In this century, the idea of vertical race is dead. We can now view race only in horizontal terms. The race one feels in oneself is everything. The anatomic geographic group to which one belongs means nothing. In this stage of our cultural development, the principle of individuality reasserts itself as it asserted itself in the earliest days of the Gothic. During the Dark Age of Materialism, it was believed that heredity and environment were everything. With the decline of materialism, the human soul regains its former dignity. Everyone must now openly admit that the engrafting of the outworn nonsense of the vertical race notion onto the glorious European resurgence of authority brought about by the European Revolution of 1933 was an enormous tragedy. All the more so since the coupling of these two ideas was in no way necessary or even logical. In the classical culture, any man who is ethically equal to the inner imperative of Roman spirituality could rightly say, Qui Romanus sum, I am a citizen of Rome. In this, our Western culture is somewhat akin to the classical. Our touchstone of comradeship and belonging is spiritual ethical, not the old one of birthplace, cephalic index, eye color. And he's kind of like in the camp of the saints, where some of the loyalists to France and Europe are even former colonials who are dark-skinned and of a different race, but they are of that culture. He's somewhat arguing the same thing there. And even those darkies see the tragedy of Europe being destroyed by third worlders showing up on boats and just coming in. In the 20th century, the century of elective affinities, materialistic tests are pure stupidity. One last word on the relation of Germany to Europe. The adoption of the German formative ethic of authoritarian socialism by all Europe means, of course, the automatic disappearance of Germany as a petty state. The anglicizing of Europe in the 19th century did not mean the Europeanizing of England, for the 19th century was the age of petty nationalism. However, with the coming to an end of that age, the ethical Germanization of Europe is simultaneously the Europeanization of Germany. In Germany, as elsewhere, petty statism is dead. Europe will have a Prussian ethical future, or none at all. Either authoritarian socialism will win its victory and liberate Europe from its enemies, or else Europe will be reduced permanently to Chinese conditions. Either Europe will unite in this ethical idea, or it will remain forever a collection of provinces over which the outer forces will wage their wars of plunder. The test of rationality is completely invalid in history. The test in that field is organic possibility. As to politics, Europe has but one organic possibility, the Imperium, and but one ethic, authoritarian socialism. The nations are dead, for Europe is born. What names this mighty imperium will bear in history, what languages people will speak, where its capital will be, these are secondary questions for us in the middle of the 20th century, and no one alive today will decide them. All that matters now is that unless Europe forms itself into an indivisible national political entity by dint of its nation-building ethic of authoritarian socialism, the Europe of 2050 will be essentially the same as that of 1950, viz., a museum to be looted by barbarians, a historical curiosity for sightseers from the colonies, an odd assortment of operetta states, a reservoir of human material standing at the disposal of Washington and Moscow, a loan market for New York financiers, a great beggar's colony bowing and scraping before the American tourists. In the face of Europe's terrifying position between the Second and Third World Wars, the old differences between the remnants of the old nation ideas collapse into nothing. Every man of significance in our times is history-oriented, for one cannot profoundly understand our times, their inner imperative and mission, unless one ponders deeply the meaning of Leibniz's aphorism. Le présent est chargé de phases et gros de pavenir. In his inner life, Western man cannot now take sides in the bygone struggles between Wallenstein and Gustavus Adolphus, Olivares and the Cortes, Richelieu and the Fronde, Stuarts and Parliament, Bourbons and Habsburgs, Church and State, England and Spain, Italy and Austria. Today the loftier European identifies himself with both sides in these titanic struggles, with the totality of our precious Western history, for that history is his own spiritual biography written before him in large letters. He too had his Gothic Reformation, Enlightenment, and Rationalist Revolutionary phase, his youthful religiosity and crusades, his democratic liberal communist phase, and now, in his fullest maturity, he has entered spiritually and materially the age of absolute politics, in which the struggle is planetary and its motive cultural. That means not 19th century petty states and nations, but only that culture, state, nation, imperium can take part in it. With its successes and failures, its flaws and brilliancy, its advances and retreats, Western history describes ourselves. Even with the First World War, we are still able to experience inwardly what both sides felt. But with the Second World War, the higher type of European experiences only one side, for that war was in its main an aspect of war of the West against Asia. And all men of the West who, knowing that, sided against the European Imperium were traitors to the West, inner enemies of their own culture. In 1914, it was England versus Germany, but in 1939, this was no longer the case. By 1939, the England of Walpole and North, Canning and Gladstone, Kitchener and Joseph Chamberlain was dead and buried. Replacing it was the quote-unquote England of Eden and Cooper and Churchill and Belitia, not even a recognizable caricature of the youthful England of the Independence. These were no far-sighted empire builders with unerring power calculations, but only liquidators of the empire, American agents, greeters of the, quote, valiant Red Army, unquote. As their enemy, they named the European culture, the organism of which England is a vital part, and with which it will always share a common destiny. Every English statesman of the old tradition would have recognized the growth of events during the third decade of the 20th century from a European to a global scale. But these wretched epigoni, with their boundless jealousy and muddled instincts, closed their eyes to it and sold the English island to the Washington regime for a little pseudo-power and the fleeting glory of a suicidal victory. In this historical orientation, the Westerner of the higher type, who alone has cultural value and significance, regards events in which the West was pitted against the outer forces with a completely subjective eye. Thus he sees in the Crusades, for example, only one side of the question. I'm not speaking here of any ethical, religious, moral, aesthetic, or other such questions, of course, but solely of the organic question of identity. He is for Charles XII against the Russians, for England against the Indian Mutiny, against the Zulus, and against China in the Opium War, for the Teutonic Knights against the Slav at Tannenberg, for Maximilian against Juarez, for the American colonists in the Alamo against Santa Anna, for Napoleon against Russia, for Mussolini against the Negroes of Abyssinia, for the hero and his army against Russia in 1941-45. In these events, it was left only to chance which of the Western nationalities fought the barbarian. The victory of any Western nation over an outer military foe, whether Chinese, Hindu, Zulu, Islamic, was a victory for all Europe and its colonies. Any European who gloats over the defeat of a Western nation brands himself politically and culturally feeble-minded. For what distinction does the barbarian make between Western nations? During the Second World War, the Japanese called the Germans friendly enemies and the English hostile enemies. To Jewry, all men of the West are goyim. To Islam, they are giaours, G-I-A-O-U-R-S, a word I've never seen before, and Franks, quote-unquote. And in Persia during the First World War, Walmus had the greatest difficulty making clear to the tribal chieftains why the two Frankish powers were fighting each other. For a European to emphasize any trifling differences between the Western nations today is stupidity, if not treason. Yet Anglophobia, the mode of yesterday, is back in style again. Germanophobia has been transformed by the outer forces of Washington and Moscow into a veritable hate religion for the masses. In this direction lies the Sinoization of Europe, turning it into China. Treasonous propaganda in Europe between the Second and Third World Wars has its origin with the outer enemies of Europe. Spreading it is taken care of by the inner enemy of Europe. Next chapter is, in fact, the inner enemy of Europe.